Here we're in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 11, I think. I wrote chapter 10. Oh yeah, it's still chapter 10. We didn't quite finish up here. So, 2 Kings chapter 10, Jehu has been given a commission by God to execute judgment upon the house of Ahab, who was the ruling dynasty of the northern tribes. So we can see on our timeline Ahab, the son of Omri. Ahab ruled for 21 years. His son Ahaziah ruled for just a year by himself. And then he died. Excuse me. And then his brother Joram was on the throne for 12 years, and this is when Jehu begins to execute God's judgment. And so Jehu killed Joram, the king of the north, shot him with an arrow and killed him. And then he killed also Ahaziah, the king of the south, by shooting him with an arrow. And then Jehu proceeded to wipe out all traces of Ahab's house. He sent to Samaria, where Ahab had 70 sons and grandsons being raised by guardians in the care of people there in the city of Samaria, and he had them all beheaded. And then he took care of a large group of relatives of Ahaziah, the king of the south, who were traveling up into the northern kingdom to visit. They didn't realize all that was going on. So it's been a very, very, very bloody time in the northern kingdom of Israel, as God is using Jehu to execute judgment. Now, as we said, when you're studying some of these characters, it is important not to just assume that because God is using them for judgment, that everything they do is good and right. Okay? Some of what Jehu is doing here is not. It's a violation of God's law, but God is still using him. So we get this little intermix going on in historical studies where God can be at work and he uses the sinful decisions of men to accomplish his purposes, but men are still held accountable for those things. And the prophets will actually deal with that quite a bit when we start getting to the Babylonian captivity and the Assyrian captivity, because the Israelites will wonder, how could a holy God use people like the Assyrians? They're pretty wicked people. And God's answer is, look, I'll deal with the Assyrians, but right now I'm using them to deal with you. So in God's economy of the world, nothing ever goes unnoticed. No act ever goes undealt with by God. He will bring every act and everything into judgment at some point. And so he is using Jehu to execute his judgment against Ahab, but that doesn't mean that everything that Jehu is doing is right. We're going to see that a little bit here today as we get into Jehu. He has purged Israel of Ahab's house, and now he's got another thing to purge, because what did Ahab bring to the northern kingdom? What was he well known for bringing into Israel? Idols, Baal worship. His wife Jezebel was a profound worshiper of the god Baal. And so Ahab brought a temple in. No, a Acrobat reader, I don't want to do that. So Ahab built a temple in Samaria, but he also really heavily increased the worship of the golden calves that were in northern kingdom. So now Jehu is going to be used to cleanse Baal worship out of Israel once again. This, of course, would be what God wants to happen, because which command is Israel violating by worshiping Baal? You'll have no other gods before me. So what does the word before mean in that instance? Other than? Okay. You are right. It does mean other than. Sometimes we think of before as in front of or ahead of. But if that were the case, it would mean that you can have other gods as long as they're not ahead of God. But is that the meaning? No. It means there are no gods but God. And so before means in the presence of. And it does have the implication of other than, but it really means in the presence of. So in the presence of God, you will have no other gods. So what does that mean for the nation of Israel who is dwelling in God's land? Remember, the old covenant was in some ways a lease by which Israel could continue to use the land. And so God said, you shall not have any gods in my presence. So here they've brought in Baal worship to the northern kingdom. And now in his land, in his presence, they have other gods. And God is going to deal with that. He's going to use Jehu to deal with that. So we're in verse 18 of chapter 10. It says, then Jehu assembled all the people and said to them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu will serve him much. Now, therefore, call to me all the prophets of Baal, all his worshippers, and all his priests. Let none be missing, for I have a great sacrifice to offer to Baal. Whoever is missing shall not live. But Jehu did it with cunning in order to destroy the worshippers of Baal. So, what do we think about this strategy? What's Jehu doing here? He's going to take out the prophets. And how is he getting them all together? He's promising a big sacrifice, a sacrificial feast. And he's lying. Yes, he is lying here. So this, again, we're going to get into, is he doing the right thing by trying to purge Baal worship from Israel? As the king of Israel, he's the anointed king, remember, does he have the authority from God even to use capital punishment to purge Baal worship from Israel? Yes, he does. Okay, he does have that authority. Should he be lying about it? No, no. So here again, we get this this sense about Jehu that while he's really, really zealous for this mission God gave him, his heart's not exactly with the Lord in everything that he's doing. So it's kind of an example of somebody doing the right thing for all the wrong reasons. And we'll see that develop a little bit more as we go. So the call is, bring everybody together. I want to have this huge sacrificial party. Nobody should be missing. In fact, you are all invited to my party. And if you don't come, I'll hunt you down and kill you. Maybe we should try that tactic for Christmas party, right? Yep. No. But he issues this threat, and that's one way he's trying to bring everybody together, all the worshipers of Baal, all the prophets, and all the priests. Let none be missing. But he's doing it deceitfully. So, verse 20, Jehu ordered, sanctify a solemn assembly for Baal. So they proclaimed it. And Jehu sent throughout all Israel, and all the worshipers of Baal came, so that there was not a man left who did not come. And they entered the house of Baal, and the house of Baal was filled from one end to the other. So this should tell you right off the bat that numbers themselves do not signify success, right? Just because there's a lot of people in one place doesn't mean they're right. Here's all these Baal worshipers, and they've got so many Baal worshipers in the northern kingdom that it says the house of Baal was filled from end to end. If we go back and think just a little bit ago when Ahab was king, we have the prophet Elijah very bent out of shape that he's the only one left in Israel worshiping the true God. And what did God tell him at that point? How many people were there in Israel worshiping the true God? 7,000. There were 7,000. God says, I've reserved 7,000 people in Israel, all the men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Now, that sounds pretty good, because wouldn't we like to have 7,000 people in here? I mean, that's men. That's not counting the rest of their families. So I don't think we could fit 7,000 people in here. What's our seating capacity? 250? And I think at 250, we're pretty crammed in. So 7,000 sounds like a pretty big number, but now compare it to all the people in Israel. All right? Pretty small remnant left up there who have not forsaken the God of the Mosaic Covenant and have gone off to worship Baal. Well, here's how Jehu's going to settle this. He invites the entire country, and they all show up, and everybody's there, and they're in the house of Baal. The place is filled from end to end. Verse 22, he says to him who was in charge of the wardrobe, bring out the vestments for all the worshipers of Baal. So they brought out the vestments for them. So they had special worshiping clothes just probably a robe that the men would put on. And that's what you were to attend the sacrificial feast in. And so that was the duty of the Temple of Baal, to keep those, keep them clean, keep them mended. And any time there was a sacrificial feast, to hand them out to all the people. And so that's another practice that we don't do. We don't keep your suits and ties and dresses and things here at church. You keep them at home. And choir robes used to be more of a thing than they are now. But you know, I don't even think too many churches use choir robes anymore. Eldon. Yeah, I know. We've got a closet full of them up there. Yep. But they've been in the closet for a while. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the same idea, though. If you're taking part in this sacrificial meal, they had all the robes there, and they were kind of ornate. And so you would bring them all out. Now, why do you think he's bringing out all the vestments and giving everybody the clothes? To make it seem real. Yep. Ah, it's also going to be a pretty effective marker, right? Anybody wearing it's probably pretty serious about taking part in this sacrifice. Targets. Yeah, you think, yeah, maybe the sacrificial vestments had a big red circle right here. Maybe you guys have seen the Far Side comic. Gary Larson shows a picture of two deer standing there, and one deer has a target right here on his chest. And the caption says, "Bummer of a birthmark, Hal." So, Elton. Oh, the fun stuff you can do, right? Well, yeah, these priests or these vestments are going to serve as a pretty good marker as to who is seriously involved in this thing. And it'll allow Jehu to mark the people that are involved so they can't get out. So everybody's in the house. They're all dressed up for the ceremony. Verse 23, then Jehu went into the house of Baal with Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. Do you remember we met him last week? He is apparently a well-known and fairly pious figure in Israel at the time. Jeremiah even delivers a commendation from the Lord to Jonadab's descendants for keeping their father's instructions. For 300 years, these people lived as nomads without purchasing land, without planting crops, and they supported themselves in a nomadic lifestyle. They didn't drink wine or have fancy feasts. So here's Jonadab taking part in this whole thing, and it lends it an air of righteousness to have this well-known godly figure involved in it. So he brings them out and he says to the worshipers of Baal, "Search and see that there is no servant of the Lord here among you, but only the worshipers of Baal." Why?
So no one gets killed.
So none of the worshipers of the Lord get killed, right? But why are the worshipers of Baal going to think this is going on? Why might the worshipers of Baal want the place purged of Jehovah worshipers? Well, yeah, the Jehovah worshipers are going to think that they're going to know that this is idolatry, right? So they're going to spoil the party, aren't they? And the Baal worshipers don't want that. So they don't want any naysayers there. They don't want anyone telling them this isn't what they should be doing. And so they purge the temple of anybody that worships Baal. I wonder here how Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, gets out of this. How he's in there. Did he put on the priestly garments? Is he going to take part in the sacrifice? How does this all go down with him? I wish that this is another instance where I wish they had more information for us, but God didn't see fit to give us more information, so I'm just left to use my sanctified imagination. Maybe Jehonadab at this point is not quite so righteous as he is later on. Maybe this is a formative event in his life, and this is what spurs him to really strive to seek after the covenant. Don't know. But at any rate, he's there. It's mentioned that he's there. Search, see that there's no servant of the Lord here among you, but only the worshipers of Baal. And then they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings. So they actually go through with the sacrifice. What do you think of that? Make it convincing, okay? I want to spark some lively debate here. What do you think of the ethics of this situation? Should Jehu have done this or no? No? Okay, so we can understand he's trying to make it convincing. It verifies that they are Baal worshipers, okay? But isn't he now a Baal worshiper? He doesn't think so? And since... And that's what we have to question, Kathy says. Isn't he doing this in his own strength instead of waiting on the Lord? And so we do get into that question. As the king, he does have the authority and responsibility to purge Israel of Baal worship, even using capital punishment to do it. That was an authority granted to him by God in the law. And so remember, chains of command are very, very important. Chains of authority. There is no such thing as an ultimate authority among men. God is the ultimate authority, and every other authority is a delegated one. And if it hasn't been delegated, what do we call it when somebody tries to take authority that doesn't belong to them? Go ahead, Kim. Usurping. How many of you have heard the word usurping in the last week in your common conversations? Eldon, you did? Just now, or? Good. Yes, exactly. So usurping is not a word that occurs too often, but it should. We should really be talking about usurping authority because it's a very important concept. Why should children obey their parents? Because God has delegated authority to the parents, not to the children. And if the children try to take it, they have usurped authority. They've stolen it. It may well be because the parents have relinquished it, but they do so wrongly. Now, why do we obey our governmental authorities? Because God has legitimately delegated certain authorities to them. They should stick within those limits. Otherwise, they are usurping authority. Our whole country is founded on this idea because our founding fathers understood the concept of delegated authorities. And aside, they did recognize that God is the ultimate authority and that beyond that, the authority of government comes from men. What we, not men like males, but people. Got to be careful about that stuff, don't you? But we hand over to our government all its authority. They don't just have it intrinsically. God established governments, but how much power they have is handed over to them by their subjects. And so if we continue to hand authority over to them that should be ours, we are abdicating our authority and they are usurping authority. Especially when government starts trying to cross lines, like the authority that God has rightfully given to the family or the authority that God has rightly given to the church. Those are areas that government will usurp very quickly, because they think they're an ultimate authority in themselves. But anyway, I'm digressing here. Jehu has legitimate delegated authority from God to use capital punishment to purge Baal worship from the kingdom. However, should he use deceptive means to use it? No, why not? I mean, how else is he going to get all these Baal worshipers in one place? One fell swoop. We can take care of Baal worship. God has the ability to do it, right? But God does use human instrumentation, right? And so God did tell Jehu to accomplish these things. No? Kathy's saying no. Ah, so the picture he's giving of God, you're destroying their theology. I like that. I mean, I don't like destroying theology. I like the way you're thinking about this. Okay? Oh, yes, absolutely. Yep. So how should Jehu have gone about this? Let's Just do a little thought experiment for a minute. What would be another way he could do this? Well, in one sense, God did tell him. I mean, he made him king, and with that comes the responsibility to be implementing the law. Eldon? Okay. That could be, but at the same time, I want to drive home this point that Jehu is God's judgment. So think of it this way. When you're flying down from here to Peru at 70 miles an hour, like most of us do, and the policeman flips his lights on behind you, you pull over, and he says, "Do you know how fast you were going?" And you say, "Absolutely not. I thought I was doing something like 80. And he says, "Oh, well then," writes out his ticket for you. Is that God's judgment? No? No? Gary says no. Okay. But it is still a meted out punishment for breaking the law, right? Yeah. Okay, Gary doesn't think it's... Oh, you're ruining my illustration, Gary. Got to get a better one. Tim? Okay, so I have disobeyed both man's law and God's law, right? And I'm getting a discipline for it. So we have to understand different levels of God's judgment. Usually when we think of judgment, we think of hell. We think of judgment for sin or the wrath of God against sin. But there are different types of judgment, and maybe that's causing part of our confusion here. But I say that is God's judgment on that disobedience. I violated man's law. I deserve a ticket. And so that is God's discipline or God's judgment against my disobedience. And they have done so rightly. They have the authority to give me a ticket for that. I broke the law. They give me a ticket. I pay it. And that's what it is. It doesn't imply any judgment beyond that, but that's what the judgment is. Under the old Mosaic law, the punishment for Baal worship was execution, right? You were to put people to death. But who's going to carry out that judgment? Kim? Yes. So this man had the right to follow through an original commandment given by God that wasn't needed any deception. He had every right to just round him up and execute him in whatever way they want. Right, yeah. And so one of the things Jehu might be trying to take care of here is what were the rules for execution? You have to have two witnesses, right? So how many witnesses are there that this room is full of Baal worshippers? Yeah, quite a few, right? At least Jehu and Jehonadab are there and can verify all these people and all his soldiers and things. But so on the one hand, yes, Jehu has the authority to execute these people for Baal worship. But on the other hand, the means he's using are not the God-established means. So just as the police officer has the authority to give you a ticket, and when he pulls you over and gives you a ticket, you can't say to him, "You can't do that to me. You're not allowed to give me tickets." Well, yes, he is. He has duly appointed to give you tickets. I mean, you can go to court and challenge his decision if you want to, but chances are you're probably not going to win that, and because the police officer has been duly recognized to mete out that discipline for breaking the law. Well, Jehu has the authority to do what he's doing, but what we're questioning is whether or not he's doing it the way it should be done. Because there's no trial here. There's no witnesses brought forth. He just simply pulls out the sword and begins executing them. And he does it in a very deceitful way. So he himself participates in this Baal worship and then executes everybody else who's participating in Baal worship. So another scenario that I think could have been taken is once he is on the throne and established as the king of Israel, he's already been acknowledged that by the people in Samaria and Jezreel. But once it's known throughout the entire kingdom that Jehu has been anointed king, you issue, don't you love armchair monarchs? All right, so I got done just a little bit ago practicing armchair quarterbacking for Ben Roethlisberger. Watching, are we winning? Yeah. Okay. But we can do armchair politicking too. We do this all the time. But could he have sent out an edict and said, "Hey, the Temple of Baal's done. I'm tearing it down next week. Get your stuff out of there. Anybody else caught worshiping Baal from henceforth will be tried and executed to the fullest extent of the law." And that would have been one way he could have taken. But as it stands, we say, well, we maybe don't like some of his tactics in doing this, but he does have the authority to do, to at least to carry out the executions. And so here he goes. They went in to offer the sacrifices. Now Jehu had stationed 80 men outside and said, "The man who allows any of those whom I give into your hands to escape shall forfeit his life." So there's motivation for the guards. Don't let anybody out. And how do you know who you're supposed to take out? They're wearing a robe, right? They're wearing a robe. So as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, and here again is where I say, Jehu, why did you go all the way to the end? I mean, why not? You've got them all in there. You say, hey, we're going to start. Everybody's inside. And you say, all right, now before I kill this animal, everybody close the doors and start taking care of business. But he goes ahead and offers the sacrifice. So here again, we've just got these little indications that Jehu's heart's not really with the Lord. He's all about the mission, but he's not necessarily about the God who gave the mission, because he's willing to take some of these steps that are a little less than biblical steps. So he says, "Go in and strike them down and let not a man escape." So when they put them to the sword, the guard and the officers cast them out and went into the inner room of the house of Baal. And they brought out the pillar that was in the house of Baal and burned it. This pillar would have been something like a totem pole. If you can think of a giant log carved with the images of Baal and Asherah and other gods on it. And it would have stood in the temple as an object of worship. So they take it outside and they burn it. And they demolished the pillar of Baal and demolished the house of Baal and made it a latrine to this day. Well, it's a fitting end for a house of Baal, since it was full of filth beforehand, and now it's full of filth in its after use, right? And so he destroys this house that Ahab had built. So now Jehu has destroyed the legacy of Ahab, and he is intent on wiping Ahab's influence out from Israel. He's destroyed Ahab's sons. He's destroyed Ahab's grandsons and other descendants. He even killed off all of Ahab's friends, which was another step he should not have taken, because the law specifically did forbid the implementation of that kind of scorched earth policy. You weren't allowed to put sons to death for the sins of the fathers. And so Jehu, in his zealousness, is overdoing things here. So verse 28 and following, we're going to read God's estimation of Jehu as we go on here. "Thus Jehu wiped out Baal worship from Israel." That's a good thing. That's a good thing. The mixture of false worship with the true worship of God is never a good thing. And it really ought to be the goal of our lives to be purging out from us every vestige of false worship that we brought into this life. We all know that when we come to faith in Christ, we bring baggage with us. We bring bad ideas about who God is. We bring bad ways of doing things. But that's the picture of growing in the grace and knowledge of Christ. As I read His Word more, as I get to know Him more, as I serve Him more, I learn more and more how to do things the way He tells me to and not my way. And I should be slowly purging those things out of my life. So there's a little bit of an applicational parallel there, that exactly what Jehu is doing, we should be doing on a personal level. How much toleration should we be giving to something that is false? to something that's commanded against. I mean, I might not know it's commanded against now, but the moment I realize God says, don't do that, how long should it be before I stop doing it? Ideally, immediate. You know, in practice, it takes us a while, doesn't it? Because we've probably all wrestled with, we came under conviction from something that God spoke to us about in a sermon or a book or wherever it was you read about it, and you're reading God's Word, hearing it taught, and you say, wow, this area of my life is wrong. And generally speaking, it takes some time to change that area of life and to purge that thing out. When I first came to faith in Christ, my language was not great. We'll just put it that way. You know, that took a little while to quit using those words, because you get in such a habit of using them. They just slide right on out. And probably you work or spend some time around some people that just every third or fourth word out of their mouth is some kind of a swear word, and they just don't seem to notice anything about it. Well, the truth is they don't. They don't realize it. They don't hear it. And every time they say it, you're kind of, oh boy, that just makes me cringe a little bit. And if they would get saved right today, it might change quickly. I mean, really, it took me months for the Lord to grow me out of that. But that's months, right? You think, you're a Christian now, why are you still using those words? Oh, because I'm trying here, but they just slide out once in a while. Well, that's the way growth goes. It takes time. And yet, here is a good example of the kind of zealousness with which we're supposed to pursue purging our lives of things that are not honoring to God. Don't give them any quarter. Don't give those sinful things in our lives any mercy. Paul takes up the same language in the New Testament when he says, put to death, therefore, your members that are on the earth. And then he goes through the list of the fleshly things that we do. You don't just slap them on the wrist and reprimand them. You don't just try to lock them up. You don't put them in the corner for a time out. You execute them. You kill them. And so while some of this stuff that Jehu is doing sounds harsh to our 21st century ears, because we're turning away from capital punishment altogether in a lot of thinking, not saying we should, I'm just saying that's where society's going, right? But the picture is, this is how you deal with sin. You don't tolerate it. You don't put up with it. You don't give it any mercy. When you find it in your own life, you attempt to destroy it. And so that's what God is using Jehu to do. However, verse 29, despite the fact that he was really zealous to get Baal worship out of the country, there's something he doesn't do. Jehu did not turn aside from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. That is, the golden calves that were in Bethel and Dan. This practice was established about 100 years before this, where Jeroboam set up those two golden calves, called them Jehovah, and then the whole nation worships them as if they were Jehovah. So which commandment is that violating? Yeah, don't make any graven images. It's the second commandment. So worshiping Baal is a violation of the first commandment. Worshiping these golden calves but calling them Jehovah God, it's still wrong because you're violating the second commandment. Don't make any graven images. Why are we not supposed to make images? I mean, wouldn't it help us? How many of you are visual learners? You really got to see something to learn it. So wouldn't it help you to have a picture of him? I mean, we could hang pictures of Jesus up here, right? Wouldn't that help you while you're singing to visualize that you're singing to him, Eldon? Yeah. We very quickly do that, don't we? Now, John Calvin said, my heart is an idol factory. It is constantly trying to pump out new idolatrous things. And so, yes, one of the problems is that we very quickly transition from thinking this is a visual aid to this is actually him. And this is what Israel did when Aaron made the golden calves and said, hey, Israel, this is your God. Probably he meant, hey, this is just a representation of him. But it wasn't long before they were worshiping that golden calf as God. Same thing's going on here in the north. And sin begets sin, meaning that you allow one sin in your life and it will sprout up in other places, just like that annoying crabgrass in your garden. You know, that joint grass. If you allow it in one spot in your asparagus patch, pretty soon it'll be over in your melons and sprouting up everywhere, because I have pulled roots out of that stuff that are 3 feet long and they just crawl under the ground. And if you allow sin in one area, it will pop up somewhere else. And so if you start allowing this, well, I'm going to call it God, but it's, you know, it's this picture, it's this idol, that will devolve in other areas as well. Because the trajectory you set yourself on is one of the problems of idol worship. The other problem is because what can we possibly make that accurately reflects who God is? You can never get the picture right. You never get it to reflect His glory and His greatness. It's one of the troubles we have in describing the Trinity, because people come up with illustrations to try and explain the Trinity, like, oh, it's three matches and you put them together and it makes one flame. And well, it's like an egg. It has three parts, but it's one egg. But all of those things fall far short of the glory of the incorruptible God. You cannot explain Him with those kinds of pictures. You can't represent Him that way. And so anytime we make an idol, we misrepresent Him. We get it wrong. And we portray a God that is not the true God. So Jehu purges Baal worship, but he embraces the calf worship of Jeroboam. And so he misses this opportunity to really bring Israel back to the worship of Jehovah. And if you'll remember, when God commissioned Jehu to do what he's doing, he told him, if you obey me, I'll establish your kingdom over the northern kingdom. I won't ever wipe out David's dynasty, but if you obey me, I'll establish you. And so right off the bat here, probably not more than a year into Jehu's reign, he has not done that. And we get this message from the Lord in verse 30. The Lord said to Jehu, because you have done well in carrying out what is right in my eyes and have done to the house of Ahab according to all that was in my heart, your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne. That's good. Jehu, you did what I told you to do. I told you to eliminate Ahab's house from Israel. That he did. And as a reward, you're going to get to see your sons on this throne for the fourth generation. That's better than his predecessors, because Ahab, well, let me think here. We only had three generations for Ahab. We had Omri, Ahab, and his sons Ahaziah and Jehoram were one generation because they were brothers. So we had three generations of Ahab. The house before him, the house of Baasha, only lasted for two. The house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, only lasted for two. And so Jehu's is going to be the longest dynasty so far in the northern kingdom. But, verse 31, Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord. Now there's a surprise. Right? We've seen this already. He's not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not turn from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel to sin. So here's this huge missed opportunity, where God used him for something, he's rewarded for what he did well, but he didn't go far enough in doing what was right. He did the bare minimum of what God asked him to do, and he didn't pursue God with all of his heart. So God starts to accomplish something in the northern kingdom. Verse 32, in those days the Lord began to cut off parts of Israel. Hazael, now who's Hazael?
King of Syria.
The king of Syria, right. The king of Syria, north of the nation of Israel. And Hazael was anointed by Elisha. And so it says, Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel. So Jehu becomes king. He establishes himself, but God starts peeling away and stripping off parts of the northern kingdom using Syria. Is Syria a godly nation? So how can God use Syria to execute discipline upon Israel? Well, because he's God, he does that. Whoop, that's the wrong button. He does that. He uses sinful people to accomplish his purposes. And so just to bring up our map here and kind of give us an idea of what's going on, Syria is up this way. Hazael is the king of those areas. At this point in history, Israel, the northern kingdom, starts from just about here at the northern tip of the Dead Sea, goes over to this green area on the coastland. The Philistines still inhabit most of this green area. But it encompasses these mountainous areas and goes up about to the valley of Jezreel here, but not much farther north, because Syria took those things away from Ahab many years before. So now God is allowing Syria to take more. Verse 33 gives us a little description of what else is being lost. From the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, the Gadites and the Reubenites and the Manassites, from Aroer, which is by the valley of Arnon, that is Gilead and Bashan. The valley of Aroer is down here to the south. And so all of this area east of the Jordan, everything over here has been lost. Israel no longer occupies it. It belongs to Syria. This is where, when Moses came into the land, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh settled over here because it was very good pasture land. But it's now been taken away. It doesn't belong to Israel anymore. It belongs to Syria. And it's because of Jehu's disobedience and Ahab's and all the northern kings who have been walking away from God. So verse 34, now the rest of the acts of Jehu and all that he did and all his might, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Jehu slept with his fathers, they buried him in Samaria, and Jehoahaz, his son, reigned in his place. And the time that Jehu reigned over Israel in Samaria was 28 years. That's a pretty long reign, actually. 28 years he rules, and God has promised him how many generations will sit on the throne? Four. So we're going to see four generations of Jehu's descendants on the throne of Israel. But it's not going to be a super, super prosperous time because of their disobedience. Now Israel has been reduced to just this little plot of land over here, from the Jezreel Valley south to Judah, and nothing over on this side of the river. It's all been taken away from them because of their disobedience. So, Jehu is a study in mixed blessing. He's obedient in some things, but in some things he fails majorly. And that's probably the story of most of our lives, isn't it? In some things we do really well, and some things we fail horribly. But it's also a study in how important it is to not give sin the opportunity to seed itself, to root itself, to take over. How vehemently do we battle against it in our lives when we see that it's there? And to what lengths are you willing to go to ensure that you can root it out? Sometimes it seems, drastic. But sin requires drastic measures. Any questions? Cover a lot of territory there. Don't worry, the names of the kings will not get any less confusing as we go on. It's a shame the Israelites didn't name their kings like Robert and Charles and things that we can remember. I was going to say Daniel, but yeah. Questions or comments? All right, let's go ahead and close in prayer then. Well, Father, your people are certainly that great example.